You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Ducks Confidential podcast. I am James Crepy, joined as always by Ryan Clark, and we'll be discussing this week in the final week of the season for the basketball teams, the final week of the season as a whole for the women's basketball team, and the final week of the regular season for the men's team, which plays the Mountain Schools this weekend ahead of the Pac-12 tournament next week, but obviously for the women, who just wrapped up their very short stint, which by judging by the final score and the performance as a whole, one could ask if they were at the Pac-12 tournament at all. And that is where we will start, Ryan, because no point in belaboring it. An all-time horrific season. The worst losing streak in program history ends at 14 for the year, which ties for the worst mark by any Pac-12 women's basketball teams in the Pac-12 era. Both Cal a couple of years ago in the COVID season and Arizona State last year each also lost 14 in a single season. And there are programs in the conference as it deteriorates that had worse losing streaks many moons ago. Washington State, believe it or not, actually had a 45-game losing streak that spanned two seasons. That had to really be something. Yes. Yeah, that really had to be something. So just think, it could be worse. Ducks fans, it could be worse. But alas, 14 straight, and it goes and ends with quite the exclamation point, a 79-30 loss to Colorado. Worst margin of defeat in the series history, biggest margin of defeat in Pac-12 women's basketball tournament history. And I'll be perusing through the record books, but it tops the UConn loss from 2013 in terms of margin of victory, or margin of defeat, as it were. So I am venturing to guess that if it's not the second largest margin of defeat in program history, because the worst was 65 points back in, I believe it was like 1975 or 76, if it's not second to that, then it's third. I mean, you just don't lose by 50 points very often. It's not even in the notes, let's put it that way. So I will be quite literally going through the records to define that. But what a way to end what has been an otherwise disappointing season, would be putting it mildly. An absolutely horrible season in every way imaginable. And we knew it would be difficult, knew it would be bad, knew this team was not going to be terribly competitive. And then 5 minutes in, it was going to get worse once Peyton Scott went down. But she was not going to cure all these ills. She was not going to suddenly have them win 5 or 10 more games because she was there. That's just not the case. This team was deficient in every area. Individual players, even the one or two that may have had decent statistical contributions at points, some of that, it was bent and skewed in part because of the lack of talent on this team, and which obviously leaves us and sets us up for the conversation that every fan who cares about this program, and there are many, and credit to them, and credit to the people who still showed up, even though attendance went down again relative to even last year, there are still like over 5,000 people showing up to games for this team. So there are people who still dialed in, who still care, who still want to see this program succeed. And needless to say, they're all furious, upset, emailing me and direct messaging me. That's for sure. I've got a good number of them who want change and who cannot pallet this anymore and want to see change happen. And after a performance to end a losing streak like that, it's hard to make much of a case that it shouldn't happen. We're not here to do it one way or the other, but your thoughts, Ryan, on how this ends and if it is the end of the Kelly Graves era.
Yeah, I mean, this is definitely a low point for the program over the last few years, and remarkable given obviously where they were, and we've talked about it before, and Kelly Graves has talked about it before, the idea that they were at the mountaintop and they've suddenly found this very low valley, this murky wetland that they find themselves in this season, and an uncertain future, frankly. There's a lot of fog in that wetland, right? They're looking around and wondering who's going to be in the program next year in terms of players, what this staff can do if it is retained in terms of bringing transfers in, bringing recruits in, and retooling the roster in a way that allows them to compete. But that Colorado game was the worst performance of the season and was emblematic, I think, of so many of the deep problems that existed with not only the roster, but just the performance and the style and the stale sort of approach that this season had hanging over it. 79-30. Now, Colorado, very good team, a team that could make a nice little run in the NCAA tournament, could win the entire Pac-12 tournament if it gets on a run here. So credit to that group for what I think was a comprehensive performance. But that used to be Oregon, right? That used to be a team that you feared playing, that was tough defensively, that had playmakers on offense and had the depth necessary to compete. Oregon doesn't have any of that. It's particularly on the offensive end, have been dreadful all season. Some of the worst numbers in the conference in the country. No shooting really to speak of from the outside on a consistent basis. I think Chance Gray led them in three-pointers total this year. And beyond her, I mean, really nobody that was ever making three-pointers with any semblance of regularity. And I think a bright spot obviously was Filipina Shea's development as a really solid starting center in the Pac-12, and if she sticks around, she could turn into a very good player. But you just look around the roster, I mean, their bench points, they were pummeled again by Colorado today. Most games they had single digit bench points or even like less than five. The depth that was there for previous Oregon teams just isn't there. Scoring, shooting, defense, where they would sit in this sort of unmoving zone for games at a time without adjustment, and toward the end of the season, they started to play a little more man to mix it up. That kind of helped in stretches, but at the end of the day, they don't really have the horses in the stable to win this race right now, or to even compete in the Pac-12, which is now ending, and definitely not compete in the Big Ten next year with this type of roster and this type of approach. So, yeah, people are asking that question. Is Kelly Graves going to be retained? He has maintained that, you know, those type of discussions haven't been happening, but who's to say at this point whether they have or not? We, at this point, don't know what the future holds for Oregon women's basketball. We can't say definitively one way or the other right now that Kelly Graves will be back. If I had to guess, though, given his track record, given the success over the 10 years and maybe a longer leash for a coach like him than maybe others, I would say that he would be more likely than not to come back next season. The question is, what is the level of urgency on the part of the Oregon Athletic Department to make what is potentially a hard change that might be unpopular with some fans who've admire Kelly Graves as a person?
I'd love to meet him at this point, Ryan.
Yeah,
but I know. I'm being serious. Yeah, like, yeah. I don't have a one. Okay, I give credit to this fan base and the credit to the people who do reach out, even those who are just angry at this point, because at least it's not apathy. That's one thing I could say. People are not apathetic. But I think if he were retained, the amount of people who are angry and infuriated would become apathetic. Because I don't have a single voice coming to me saying, you know, look, just hey, this was awful, but let's not lose perspective on 5 and 6 years ago. No, like there is nobody I am hearing from. And again, this is fans. I'm not using a crowdsourcing off of Twitter or X as the litmus test by which to assess whether or not to make changes in a program or not. But I have not heard a voice at all. No, nobody. Even those who can otherwise appreciate what Kelly did and his staff did with really talented players 4 and 5 and 6 years ago. But I am not hearing any voice that suggests that a change shouldn't be made at this point. And obviously, yes, those who are most upset and aggrieved or want to be aggrieved scream the loudest, no doubt. But we're glossing past because there's nothing to get into in game action, but they shot 18.9% from the field today.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not just that you barely scored. No one scored in double figures. They shot under 20%. I'm also going through the records for that. That hasn't happened in his tenure. The lowest I'm finding so far is back in 2008, a 20% shooting game. And Bev Smith was the coach. We're past the Westhead era. So this is, as I say, everything about it. I mean, look, the best news for the entire program came up within the last week, and that is Caitlin Clark declaring for the draft, because just think, she could have scored 100 on this team.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine this Oregon team against that Iowa team, particularly against Caitlin Clark, who's obviously a legend in the game. This game also had an interesting sort of sub storyline that I think extends into
this
conversation.
Because that's the other kicker that I was about to set up. This is against somebody who is not trying to kill you.
Yes.
This is against someone who's trying to be nice.
Yeah, who has a great deal of respect for you, and who is your, you know, former assistant and somebody who you coached. And frankly, you know, if that sort of change is made, and we don't know whether that's the case yet, but if it is made,
would be at the top of the list.
Yeah, she'd be at the top of the list. J.R. Payne is the coach of Colorado. She's done a great job there. Started the season out with an upset of LSU and has built out a tremendous year with a group that seems really bought in and you know, gets it in terms of building out the program. Now, that's not to say that somebody like Kelly Graves can't rebound from this, but you look at somebody like that as a potential option if you do make that move. And I'm wondering too, James, like, I guess others that, you know, come to mind for you in terms of potential candidates should Oregon go that route.
Yeah, and look, you call it what it is. I hate even conjecture like this in a lot of ways, because at times you could say, look, are you really being fair? And, you know, it's two and three steps ahead of the conversation and what's actually happened. But under the circumstances where this has been the only thing the audience has who's been paying attention to and still dived into the program wants to know and wants to talk about for the last 2 years. Because for as bad as the season is, the portrayal that, well, this is a super young team, and yeah, the injury to Scott hurt, and well, there's all these things. No. This has been a steady decline for 4 years. We've talked about it in passing before, but this is not a one-off. This is not an aberration. This has been set up. This was predictable. Yes, again, maybe it wouldn't have been as extreme had Scott not gotten hurt, but it still would have been really bad. I don't think it is unfair under those circumstances. And again, and Kelly's had a chance to answer for multiple times and address the potential of his future and what he thinks about it. So under those circumstances, I don't think it's an unfair conversation for us to have or anybody to have, because it's the only one the fans are having. If a change is made, then who would the quote unquote potential candidates be? I would say J.R. Payne would be at or near the top of the list. I think Cammy Etheridge at Washington State, because of the success that she's been able to have there. And also, yes, that Washington State is headed to a very, very less prosperous future in the WCC, at least for a couple of years. So there's that. Obviously, fans of the program have been clamoring for and demanding Mark Campbell. Who am I to say otherwise? But bear in mind, he is in just one season at TCU. And I have no idea what his contract is there, because as a private school, they don't have to disclose that. So is it entirely possible that any number of you know, commitments and the like. And I think that's kind of an important thing to lay as a groundwork to the conversation too, Ryan, is, and we've mentioned it, and I think in at least one of our previous stories, but if a change is made, and the program parts ways with Kelly Graves, you know, this isn't being done for free. There is a business here, and it does cost $1.5 million to do so. So when you factor in, now you could say, well, if you're already paying them over, you know, nearly $1.1 million, you know, one way or the other, there's a degree of sunk cost. It's a matter of how much further you want to go. Well, how many universities out there, at all, are willing to foot a bill for, let's call it what it is, it would be north of three, probably almost four, and maybe more than that, million, to part ways with one coach, buy out another coach, and then pay that coach more than you're already paying Kelly and his staff. That's a pretty hefty bill. Now, it's not a matter of whether right, wrong, do it, don't do it. Again, if we're not here to convince you one way or the other, but these are the circumstances. And while certainly the sport is growing, revenues are growing, there's ticket sale interest, et cetera, and the move to the Big Ten and all the other things. Yeah, but in history, how many programs have been willing, how many departments have been willing to foot a bill of that magnitude to make a change in a women's basketball coach? And the answer historically is not very many. So is it possible? I mean, again, this is business. There's a cost of doing business if that's the decision that's made, but it would be significant. And in terms of buyouts and other things, again, Graves has 1.5. As to what else is out there to then poach somebody else, if that is the decision, and then pay them accordingly. You know, there's a lot of pieces there, but I'd start with, like I say, and mentioning potential candidates, J.R. Payne, Cammy Etheridge, Mark Campbell, Lynn Roberts at Utah has also done, obviously, a really good job there the last few years. Those would be, if I had to put together a very short list, those would be the candidates on that short list. Those that were, you know, obviously having some great success, those who are heading to either really uncertain futures in the case of Washington State, or comparatively speaking, you know, less competitive in a conference. And what does that mean to recruiting at places like Colorado and Utah in the Big 12 for women's basketball? As incredible as it is in men's basketball, it's not, you know, the shame of the Pac-12 deteriorating as far as this sport's concerned is that this was the best was the best conference in the country in terms of, you know, overall top end teams. Although we'll see when the NCAA tournament happens, whether it's South Carolina or LSU or the like, that maybe the best team may be elsewhere, but the best collection of teams, it's hard to argue, is not from this league, but now this league is spreading in a lot of different ways. So we'll see. We'll see what obviously the next several days have in store, but are there qualified, are there quality coaches out there if a change was made? Certainly, including those who have had success in the league that it stands, those that have had success while affiliated with the program. We'll see again, but
yeah. I think that the contract conversation is an important one to have too, because you know, in a sport like this, that obviously is a massive hurdle, and it's something that I think makes it significantly less likely for Oregon in this sort of transition time to not only have to transition your program to a new conference, but to have to do so under the circumstances of bringing in a completely new staff. Like that's an unquestionable challenge. And the other piece too is the idea that, you know, in these type of sports, yes, you mentioned it, I think that those type of decisions in general are less likely to be made. I mean, there's a reason why there are so many coaches across women's college basketball that have been in programs 25, 30, and sometimes even close to 40 years is, you know, they see that stability, and they see sort of the ups and downs as an inevitability. But if you can build a steady, solid upward momentum, then you're trusted with the keys to the program for a long time. And I could absolutely see it going that way for Kelly as well. I think he's somebody that's built a lot of, you know, standing in the community and has shown clearly that he cares about Oregon athletics in general and sort of selling that brand to recruits and to transfers. Now, whether he can continue to successfully do so is obviously a question in the coming years. And, you know, this season is the fruit to bear for that not happening. So, you know, there's a lot of questions up in the air, but I do think that somebody like Graves is the type of person that is more likely to get that longer leash and stick around in the at least the short term, a year or two into the Big Ten era before, like obviously if this sort of season happens again next year, it's a much different conversation because, you know, two of these types of years in a row.
But the same point, look, what fans want to know when you present that, Ryan, is why should they believe it won't happen?
Yeah, at this point, unless there is major change in the offseason, they would expect it would happen, and it might even be worse given the level of competition in the Big Ten, right?
Right.
So that's the conversation, and that's the unfortunate part about covering college sports and being around these sort of programs is you're around, you know, good people that have good intentions, and there's a lot of external factors at play. But by the same token, you know, it's a competitive sport. It's something that demands excellence, and
you paid money. This is competitive sport. You paid to win.
Yeah, that's it. And you're paid to win. So yeah, that's the nature of the beast.
And look, part of it also, you know, in terms of, you know, pieces going forward, and obviously, you know, we'll see in the days and weeks ahead also, regardless of what the institution chooses to do by way of leadership and Kelly Graves, we'll see what players choose to do. But, you know, what do you think? You're the only one having the conversation about what a player should do or not, or that it hasn't gone through their mind or not? Now, again, we're not going to get in here and get into all kind of speculative conjecture about what these young women will choose to do or not. They'll speak for themselves. Maybe. And I say maybe because until today's postgame press conference in Las Vegas that our colleague Nick Daschle is at, cover both Oregon and Oregon State while he's there. You know, there hasn't been a player who's spoken in a postgame in, I think, over a month. So maybe they'll speak for themselves. Like I say, I don't want to go too far and be too presumptuous because we haven't heard from anybody. They've been barred from speaking for quite a while. So who knows? But their actions soon will be speaking for themselves. But in terms of pieces that could return, I mean, Kelly says today, on postgame radio after the game that he thinks there are, you know, good young pieces. And I'm looking going, unless you're referring to Sophia Bell, who unfortunately also got hurt this year and was unable to play for nearly half the season. I'm not sure exactly who he's referring to by way of from a freshman standpoint or something. Yes, you know, she played well at times. She did. But in terms of if you wanted to say if everybody came back, and that is a big if, but if everybody came back, who is the quote unquote young piece anymore? Your core was Van Sluten and Gray, and they're about to be juniors, and Shea is going to be entering her senior year. So the only truly young piece that I can identify at this point is Bell. Like I say, Rambis, I guess, maybe. But, I mean, she averaged 3.5 points. I'm not saying one way or the other, but like,
I suppose maybe some of the young pieces are still playing high school basketball, but that's
entirely possible. Yeah, if you want to go that route. But I mean, obviously, you know, they're not going to suddenly get to. They're not going to go from 11 and 21 to 20 and 11 because a freshman carried them there. Unless that freshman is Juju Watkins.
Yeah, unless this point guard coming in from Seattle is the second coming of Juju, I don't think that's terribly possible.
So realistically, I mean, they have to address it in the portal. Well, they're going to have to address it in the portal no matter who the coaching staff is. But just being realistic, this team, if the idea is, well, if you bring back the three leading scorers and Sophia Bell is healthy, that's 4, and then Peyton Scott's 5, and then what changed? What changed from what you just trotted out there? You want to talk about depth in the bench? That's it? That was the fix? That's the answer? No, I think you need to create a lot more competition at a lot more spots. So as I say, obviously, look, it's a horrific way to end. Absolutely terrible. In every way, there's no sugarcoating it. We're not employed by Pac-12 Network. We're not here to put an unbelievable silver lining of positivity on something that was just an absolutely dreadful performance.
Yeah, shout out to the folks at Pac-12 Network, though, for giving us a shout out on one of the recent Oregon women's basketball broadcasts, they shouted out my story on Filipina Shea, so that was nice of them. But I get what you're saying.
Yeah,
on the spin zone. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, during the course of the broadcast, I mean, at times, yeah, at least by mid, you know, later in the third and throughout the fourth, at least they conceded that the game was over. I mean, I'll give them that. But look. Bottom line, it's been a brutal year. We've talked about it for several weeks now. And obviously the conversation that many fans were already having and have been having, like I say, for the better part of 2 years. And that's not hyperbole. I believe I have the emails to prove it. From some who are very, very, very passionate. They want to know, not only want to know anymore, they're demanding. And the only thing I can say to fans who want that change, who are around the corner, who cannot be turned back, who will be more angry if Kelly and his staff are retained than if a change is made, certainly, or than they are today, that they are demanding change, not just talking about it or maybe even wanting it, demanding it. Then you got to put your money where your mouth is. That goes for anybody in any sport, at any program. I don't care what we're talking about. I would say that of pros. Well, you can't necessarily get a professional coach fired because of money. Yeah, you can. You don't show up. You don't watch games. You don't buy tickets. You don't watch on television. That's how you speak with, you know, you have the power of the purse strings. If you're demanding change now and not just talking about it, not just emailing writers about it, not just weighing in and saying, oh, they ought to, or oh, this isn't good, or oh, so-and-so's doing better, and oh, did you see what this former assistant's doing? If you're truly demanding it, and are infuriated, well, then channel that energy and put your money where your mouth is. And I'm not saying that in a challenging way or a derogatory way. I'm saying if you're really demanding it, well, again, the bill is $1.5 million to Kelly Graves and whatever it would be to get somebody else and whatever it would be to pay that person. So unless you're going to contribute to the pot, at this point, letting some steam loose and I imagine the messages will keep coming to me. But I can't make change happen, nor is it my job to make change happen, nor is it my job not to make change happen. We are here to chronicle what does or doesn't happen along the way.
Yes, and you know who isn't going anywhere? Dana Altman.
No, he's not. No, yes. He's not. Though there has been much conjecture from national college basketball reporters that setting up the coaching carousel conversation for ahead of an offseason as to where, well, obviously changes have already been made, including, unfortunately, for Tony Stubblefield, the former Oregon assistant at DePaul, among other places, Ohio State being another. So changes have already happened in season. Where else could changes happen? And for some reason, a couple of national reporters who I can tell you haven't covered a game at Oregon, at least during my time out here. And one could argue they haven't had much of a reason to do so the last couple of years, but neither here nor there. Wax poetic that, there's talk, there's scuttlebutt, there's rumors, there's murmurings that Dana was talking about or considering retiring. And he had a chance to address that yesterday and just said, no, that is not happening. He's not going anywhere. Now, of course, you know, the jaded and the cynical will say, well, Nick Saban said those things and then he retired. And this person said those things and they retired or whatever. Again, proof will be in the pudding. What do you want us to tell you? The man had an opportunity to address it. And even before opportunity to address it, he was speaking of non-conference schedules for the next two seasons as recently as last week. And setting up games and when to schedule the Oregon State game and MTE events and neutral sites and travel in the Big Ten and how they're going to do that. And not in a bad way, not in a grumpy way, not in a, oh my gosh, this is a terrible way. No, like just laying out what the framework is. Again, could you do all those things and still change his mind? Sure, of course. But for those who know Dana Altman and whatnot, for one, I have no reason to disbelieve him when he says it because credit to him, he's a coach who, like, you ask about injuries and he's usually quite forthright about a lot of things.
Yeah, he might even say it before people ask, like,
yeah,
the other day
just volunteer it.
Yeah, he was talking about Cousinard being sick during practice. There's a lot of coaches that'd be pretty tight-lipped about stuff like that.
Yeah, so Look, he just calls it what it is. So Dana's a pretty forthright guy, and not to say like you know, hey, it's at the end of a season, so it's like, oh, there's rumors about retirement. There are ways to not answer that without outright shooting it down, where you go like, well, he didn't exactly deny it, but he didn't say it. You know, there's ways to parse words. The other part with Dane also is, I understand everybody's going to start counting everybody else's age, which I think at times is a little bit of a it's an interesting perspective. So people, some people take at times with that. I didn't realize that that this was a job like manual labor that was such a problem. But okay, but Dane is not somebody who's like looking to go set up on a beach house and not be around basketball for the next 30 years.
He loves the game. He's obsessive about it.
Yeah. This is who he is. This is what he does. And he's damn good at it, in case you forgot. And I realized that, you know, this could be a third year in a row bound for the NIT, and that's short, and that's disappointing, and that's not the standard. Yeah, I get all those things. But are you suggesting that if he did retire, or for a couple of lunatics who actually want him fired, which I mean, oh my God, like get a little grip of your horses, folks, for those who would be demanding that. But okay, you're suggesting that Oregon can go out and poach and attain another Hall of Fame coach who's won 20 games, what will be, because whether it be this week or in the Pac-12 tournament or sometime in the NIT or elsewhere, another 20 game season, 14 years in a row. You mean there's somebody of that elk out there that they can go out and attract tomorrow?
No chance.
I mean, come on now. That's not to say that there aren't quality assistants somewhere, or that, you know, some coach out there isn't, you know, the new hot thing, or that Kyle Smith at Washington State, as an example, isn't having an incredible year and has been asked about contract and his future because, Washington State is to the WCC and they don't have a lot of money anymore. And what's that going to look like? Right. But, I mean, come on now. I mean, look, to the issue at hand, is he or isn't he retiring? He's had a chance to address it. He shot it down. He said, I'm not retiring, that's for sure. He hasn't talked to anybody by way of the national reporting type. So it's just a lot of, as he called it, speculation. And that's all it is. And again, I have not heard anything to the contrary. And I do keep in contact with some folks who are, you know, quite plugged in there, where if there was even a whisper of it, I would like to think I would have heard something to the ilk of. Very much like has happened in Tuscaloosa for the last year plus, with everything around Saban, where it was a conversation, and yes, he was older, and yes, there was age, and yes, there was NIL and the portal and all the other things. But you don't hear Dana Altman waxing poetic and being critical about that.
No, he's adjusted. He's been one of the more seasoned coaches to just, you know, slide right into the new suit. He hasn't really been terribly bothered by it.
Yeah, if you want to say, look, they ought to get better players, or the guys they got weren't as good as, or what, okay, that's a perfectly valid, you know, perspective or criticism if you want to take it. Okay, but you can't say, like, what, that they didn't attract anybody? Or that they were only going to the bargain basement, or they weren't recruiting well, or they hadn't. They recruited well, unfortunately, for Oregon's purposes. One of their main three recruits for this year, one of their three freshmen, barely played because he was hurt. And he walked in hurt, and the season lasted five games for him. And some of the guys that got in the transfer portal got hurt and the like. And that'll be
everybody got hurt.
Yeah, a lot of people got hurt. They've lost over 100 games of participation by way of the players of several of whom only played five games. Nate Biddle being one, Jesse Zarzuela, Mookie Cook. Well, that's 24 games and counting, I believe it is, on a per player basis of games missed by those three each. And then you add in Barthelemy and his ankle injury, and you know, Shellstad missed a couple of games, and Dante missed 12, 13, 14, you know, games. So you start racking it all up, and yeah, obviously it's been brutal. But again, for those, if you want to point again, there's plenty of people who want to get after the training staff and the strength staff, and some, you want to find somebody to blame for all those things. That's a different conversation entirely. To Dana Altman, his position, he's the most successful coach in program history. Everything's about, that's also true of Kelly, and you could say, what's the difference? Well, the difference is the trajectories of the programs, the overall performance of the program, that while it may not have been as successful as 3 and 4 years ago, there is improvement. They could still win 20 games. They could still finish in the top four of the league. It will take winning the conference tournament for the to get to the NCAA tournament, but that is still out there and possible. But for all the issues that this team has had this year, mainly around health, and the inconsistencies and inability to string together more than back-to-back wins since early January, for all those things, other than Arizona, there is no one in this league who you can unequivocally say, and I realize the league is terrible, it is, but there's no one in this league you can unequivocally say, what, shot past them? No. Yes, Washington State's having a better season, but they did split the season series. So, and we'll see if they meet again in the conference tournament. But point being, this team's still fighting, competitive, probably going to win 20 games, if not in the regular season, certainly by the end of the season, for a 14th straight season, could finish in the top four. And whether they're bound for the NIT again or not, the issues of a year ago, they couldn't shoot the three, they're shooting better. This team's problems are lack of depth because of injury and defense. So new set of problems. But there's other issues. The other issues are things that you can resolve. The other things are, okay, well, you can try and attract, retain the best players that you got, build around them. It's going to be hard to do when you lose Cousinard and Dante, who are two best players. You're going to lose them after the season. That's difficult. But they have good players set to come in. They're going to be able to attract good players. Frankly, I think they're going to be able to attract better players going into the Big Ten. I think one of the things that's been challenging for Oregon in terms of the transfer portal and those things has been the Pac-12 for the past couple of years. In particular, in this era of NIL and the portal, if you were a premier level, a all-conference, or forget about all-American, all-conference caliber basketball player looking to move either within the power, what we would call the power six or seven in college basketball, if you were looking to move within it or move up to it, and you had teams from, you name the conference out there, and teams from the Pac-12, chances are you weren't looking at a whole lot of teams in the Pac-12. If it weren't Arizona, UCLA, or maybe Oregon. And look, they got a few, and some have worked, some haven't. Cousinard was one that did. For all those who want to act like, they never got any good players via the portal, the best player on the team did come via the transfer portal, in case everybody forgot. So that happened. That did occur. And Jesse Zarzuela, who unfortunately got injured after five games, but was off to a decent start at the beginning of the season. Keyshawn Barthelemy, a pretty important piece to this team, came via the transfer portal, yes, within the conference from Colorado. And I'm not telling you these guys are All-American calibers, though Cousinard is awfully good. But they've been able to track some. Have others always panned out? No. But I think part of that also is the conference. And, hey, am I on television? And who am I playing? And all the other issues that come with it. Well, now you're going to be playing in the Big Ten. Now you're going to be playing against Michigan and Michigan State and Ohio State and Indiana and Purdue and Iowa and Wisconsin every year. Literally every year. You're playing every one of those teams at least once every single season. And oh yeah, you're still playing UCLA twice. And you very well could play Arizona in non-conference play. So I think the ability to attract and retain talent in both basketball programs, but especially in the men's side, is about to become easier, not harder. And I have no reason to disbelieve. And look, we mentioned Tony Stubblefield a few minutes ago in the conversation. He could come back. And that's not speculation. That's the day, unfortunately, that Tony got let go from DePaul. I'd ask Dana, because of course you do, because he'd spent over a decade here and was a great lead assistant. And it's not suddenly like he became a less knowledgeable coach. Okay, it didn't work at DePaul as a head coach. Okay, but can he still be an assistant and come back to the staff? And Dana's outright saying, all right, it's not going to happen lickety-split within a month for the Ranger this season, but I hope he comes back. I hope he gives us a look. Yeah, he very well could. So there's lots of reasons for optimism about the future and the trajectory of the men's basketball program, particularly with Dana saying he's going to be coming back and he's not going anywhere, particularly with the pieces that they have in line to come back and those set to come in. And yes, and joining the Big Ten. Now, it's going to be more competitive. It's going to be harder. Yeah, it's going to be all those things. But I think the overall trajectory and what to feel about into the future for that program is, it's hard to be particularly critical unless there was a mass set of departures by way of players as soon as the season's over. I don't know how you're going into it with a set of gloom or something. I don't. I think there's a lot to build around here.
No,
that they have a chance to work with.
I think so too. I think that, you know, whether this season ends with them making a nice run in the Pac-12 tournament and getting themselves a spot in the NCAAs or not, I think there is a sort of understanding that, yeah, they're going to be on that bigger stage next year. And these 3 years are nothing to sneeze at. Yeah, it's down, you know, from the quote unquote standard of before, but it's not, you didn't lose 15 straight games to end the season. you just are a slightly worse 20 something win team than playing in a bad conference and having a lot of injury issues. There's a lot of layers to it for them. And this week, obviously they play Colorado and Utah, and that'll finish up the regular season schedule. Oregon obviously would like to get a pair of wins out of that, especially that Colorado game for seeding's sake in the Pac-12 tournament. But I'm interested to know your thoughts on that Pac-12 tournament. Is it a win or bust situation for them to get into the NCAAs, or if they win these two and you think about net rankings and everything else, but if they win these final two and then they make a run, play Arizona and play them tough in that final, a lot has to happen to get to that point. But I mean, just thinking about it, what's are they on the bubble then? Are they back in there?
I think if they win these two, if Oregon wins these two games, which is, it would take a lot. Look, they were swept at the Mountain Schools for the first time ever, but they were. So it's going to take a lot to win either, let alone both. But if they were to sweep both, which finishes third, so they would get the winner of the 6-11, which there's much to be sorted out as to who that will be. And then, presumably, if you win that game, you go on and play the two, who would be Washington State. So you're talking about winning four games in a row for the first time since, like I say, early January, spanning back into December, and doing it against two teams who are in the bubble conversation, on the outside looking in for most trajectories, then picking up what would be your best win of the season, or one of the best wins of the season in Washington State on a neutral floor. Is that enough? At this point, I'd still say no, because they just don't have enough volume of high quality wins. At this point, basically, those would be all the quality wins. Those and the win over Wazoo at Wazoo,
yeah,
in January. Those would be the only high caliber, high quality wins that the team has.
Especially if that championship game went the way of this most recent game over the weekend, right? If they get blown out, I mean, and then it's just like, okay, Arizona is it. They're the ones that get to show up for the Pac-12.
And look, a lot of teams are getting crushed by Arizona, too.
Sure,
that's the other part of it.
Yeah, you think about them compared to the rest of the conference. It's like it becomes clearer in the ideas of in the eyes of the committee, you know? So
yeah, I just can't see in the math. I've said for several weeks now, I just can't. I realize that these games certainly have meaning, and look, and they need both to assure themselves of third. But you know, yes, Colorado's first, and you need to win that to stay alive for third. If you lose that game, third's off the table. And then conversely, if you lose both, if you're swept the other way, you forget about third, you lose fourth. In all likelihood, yes, this is all under the presumption that Utah beats Oregon State. But in all likelihood, if you lose both, forget about third, you lose the bye. And fourth would also mean playing Arizona in the second round, if you were so fortunate to get to the semifinal in the first place. But yeah, you really need both of these games to feel particularly comfortable and confident going into the conference tournament, but no less than one, because like I say, with both, assuming that Utah beats Oregon State, then you're looking at a 5-12. And by the way, the 5-12 is a third matchup with Oregon State, which for whatever reason, as we have talked about before, this team has insisted upon making that matchup unbelievably competitive at times when it was unnecessary, and doing so for a third time and a final time, a third time this season and a final time in the annals of Pac-12 records to boot, when obviously it has been the case already, but would be the season for Oregon State, not only because it would be the end of the season by way of if they lose, they go home, but that would make their season. Ending Oregon season in what would be a 5-12 matchup in the Pac-12 tournament, or even if you want to say they're the 4 and Oregon State wins the 5-12 and then plays Oregon, whatever, beating Oregon in the Pac-12 tournament would be that would be the Super, you know, call it what it is. That would be the championship. That would be the Super Bowl. That would be whatever analogy you want, all those things. So bottom line, this week's important. It's important for seeding. It's important for putting yourself in a position to try to put a run together in Vegas. But before you can worry about how to do that run in Vegas and who it's against and the like, you got to finish against these two teams who Oregon lost to on the road. Yes, it was a minute ago for sure, but they got to hold court. You know, they got to hold serve here and win two games that they really need. They need for the seeding purposes, because like I say, without it, you're looking at a 5-12 opening round matchup with a team who gave you some fight, and it would mean everything in the world to them to beat you, even though Oregon has had, you know, command in that series for a minute now. So we will certainly get into that more next week. But we spent this week obviously spending all of our time and much of our time on this longer edition of the podcast exclusively on the basketball programs, because things are wrapping up. And obviously with what was extremely disappointing for the women's basketball program and a future that we will obviously be chronicling in the days and weeks ahead, and what will be a pivotal week by way of how this season and how the season end, regular season end standings, et cetera, for the men's basketball program. So we appreciate you for listening as always. Reminder again, if you don't already, like, subscribe, 5-star review, all those things. So that way it helps more Ducks fans find us. And you can listen to all the other fine editions of podcasts on the Oregonian Sports Podcast channel to hear from all of our other colleagues and all of the other beats and teams, et cetera, across the state. So for Ryan Clark, I am James Crepe. We thank you, and we will chat with you next week.